Thanks a lot.
Let us assume a third toke, long and slow. You vaporize, and you take it in and in and in, and there is a sound like the crumpling of a plastic bread wrapper, or the crackling or the flame, and a tone, a
All right, you're listening to Kootenai Club Radio, 93.5 FM, CGLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaiclubradio.com.
There is a cheer. The gnomes have learned a new way to say who.
Right, welcome. This is Fane of the Cosmos.
Infinite Moment.
I'm one of your hosts, Dustin Sunflower.
And I'm one of your hosts, Reverend DeMuzzi.
And on today's show, we're going to be talking about Plan Colombia and how the United States will not be planning to invade Iran, but rather Venezuela. We'll find out the details later in the show.
Yeah, we'll also be talking about the New World Order. Happy New World Order to all you listeners out there.
Happy New World Order.
So, a little bit about what's going on around the world and in the world of oppression and keeping track of your fingerprints and your whereabouts at all times.
Oh, great. We'll also be talking about a stocking stuffer that I got this Christmas, the Crystal Meth Crystal Growing Lab.
What?
You'll find out later on the show, listeners. Stay tuned. It was a stocking stuffer extraordinaire.
That's weird. Well, I was going to interview somebody who basically the editor of the Annotated Hashish Eater, which was this excellent CD that you can get and you put in your computer. And you can read the whole thing. It's by Fitzhugh Ludlow. It's this book that was written in 1850s, which inspired a whole sort of movement of hash dens all across the U.S., which preceded Prohibition. But unfortunately, the editor of that won't be available. But we can still talk about hashish.
He may call.
I should have called him earlier. I guess we could always get him on another week, too.
But. Yeah. We'll also be having our weekly segment of Bad Cop, No Donut, and also Terrence McKenna, Man and Woman, which is actually great because it's Terrence and this woman's name who I can't ever remember it, but talking about patriarchy, talking about matriarchy, talking about the real goods, fraternity. So
maybe we'll leave the Annotated Hashish Eater till next week or the week after.
Okay.
We'll get the guy there. We'll get him on the show.
Okay, here we go. Right into the show.
Comes a little thing to make them jump and twist. From Santa Cruz, New York, straight down to Paris. What?
Everybody get up and go. Them style. You want in row.
holler for my dogs and sledges. I'm very intricate. You want in, go get the bandages. You want your straight from the bridges. Proper like a pasta out of Selfridges. Very legendary, just like Dand and Bridges. Dapper just like me, mother call me Parridges. Head knock with me dogs and sledges. 25 mil and 56 bitches. Got me survival box, 17 pitches. Very well equipped with 50 languages. The Panama shall be conquer out on the edges. What? Lyrics that you young like Benson and Hedges. Make a sound guy jump from half of the ledges. Sweeter than chicken breast with wedges. Cause everybody get up and go. Them style. You want in bro. Holla for my dogs and sledges. I'm with every inch of kicking. You want in bro. Round one, hit the club. Round two, hit the club. All of my people, then come give me some love. What? Baseline gone down to serve.
We're not gonna rip out the pain about the disadvantages.
What?
Go against the grain, make it advantageous. Give me the mainstream, come if we inject with images. Get up, get up. Uphill struggle from the genesis. Fuck up, no producer with them promises. Fuck up, no engineer with them promises. Head massive and boost up with them promises. And then they never return me letters or messages. Very, very ambitious, they could get a kid. Who knows me, let up, I can't stop this. Run on me phone bill and mash up them, the privilege. And still me get enough support coming from me family.
Everybody get up and go. Them style. You want in bro. Holla for my dogs and sledges. I'm with every inch of kicking. You want in bro. Round one, hit the club. Round two, hit the club. All of my people, then come give me some love.
What?
Baseline gone down to serve. Everybody get up and go.
Them style.
You want in bro. Holla for my dogs and sledges. I'm with every inch of kicking. You want in bro. Round one, hit the club. Round two, hit the club. All of my people, then come give me some love.
What?
Baseline gone down to serve.
Number one, shit, and number two, with high percentages.
What?
Number one, better averages. Various advantages. Boom blast, mash up everything. I will not take no hostages. Celebration over these beverages. With me get to you, them from the villages. Celebrate with respect for the privilege. Hydrate that for burn champagne villages. Head not with me dogs and sledges. 25 mil and 56 bitches. Survival book 17 pages. Well equipped with 50 languages.
What?
With a style we broke up Sacramento. Them say me wicked, call me well temperamental. Boom blast me and the paradisco. Mash up bash men straight down to disco.
Everybody get up and go.
Them style.
You want in bro. Holla for my dogs and sledges. I'm with every inch of kicking. You want in bro. Round one, hit the club. Round two, hit the club. All of my people, then come give me some love.
What?
Baseline gone down to serve. Everybody get up and go.
Them style.
You want in bro. Holla for my dogs and sledges. I'm with every inch of kicking. You want in bro. Round one, hit the club. Round two, hit the club. All of my people, then come give me some love.
What?
Baseline gone down to serve.
Welcome back, listeners. That was Freestylers from the album Raw as Buck.
Really,
now we're going to be talking New World Order. Now, is that a band?
The New World. I think it is a band, actually, isn't it?
No, New Order? No, I can't remember. But anyway.
It's a band of jerks who are trying to take over the world.
Yipes. So what's going down?
Well, you know, the New Year is generally considered a good time to look back over one's faults and consider changing for the better. Unfortunately, what's good medicine for us regular folk is hardly ever sweet enough for the rulers of our world. But, I don't know, why don't we take a look back? It's been a long time since there's been some good self-criticism, well before 9-1-1. But why don't we start there anyways? I think it was like shortly after 9-11 that it became clear that the war on terrorism would be a new front for the erosion of human rights and freedoms. Just before 9-11, President Vicente Fox of Mexico and a group of South American leaders finally stood up to Plan Colombia and to the Andean Initiative. And they said to President Bush, this is it, we've had it. In fact, President Fox made a personal visit to President Bush and said, this is it, we've had it with the war on drugs. We want it to end now. And President Bush was pretty taken aback by it. It was a very unexpected move. It was reported in some of the media. Then, right when we were expecting, you know, everything was ready to crumble, the whole, and you've got to remember what the thing about the war on drugs is, it's part of a larger psychops that's being played on basically North Americans and, well, people all over the
Everybody,
world.
Everybody, mainly indigenous peoples of the world, really.
Well, no, it's a psychops on everybody, because the idea here is that we're going to create a mass fear hysteria, and that mass fear hysteria, and this is something that we've heard before from other people, but it's a part of the fuel for what the governments are using as a justification. It's part of their justification for going into homes and raiding people and taking away our civil rights and abusing us and stuff, just basically making us afraid so we think that we have to give up these privileges. So that right before this psychops was about to crumble, and this is a big thing. I think that people really underestimate how big this is and how real this is, that there has to be something in place to maintain this fear, this hegemony. So right before this happened, we had 9/11, and right after that, President Fox's demands were never heard from again, and that was the end of the South American leaders banding together to try to get the states to stop their drug war. In fact, suddenly we had talk of terrorists again, and, you know, hiding out in various South American states, which, you know, perfectly fit the agenda of the ruling classes. It seems an unspoken creed of those elite that those who demand privileges and freedoms must be rounded up and destroyed at any cost. And so it's a good thing that it's easy to tell who they are. They're the advocates of the poor, they're the advocates of the environment, and yes, they're even pot advocates. In the minds of our rulers, these issues are all one and the same, and thus the war on terrorism is an effective new justification to push forward with the war on drugs. This truth is never more clear than upon a trip to the DEA's traveling exhibit, Target America, Drug Traffickers, Terrorists, and You, which featured a chunk of blasted concrete and wire left over from the collapse of the World Trade Center, along with a collage featuring drug users, jets striking buildings, and Bin Laden. So it follows that although they have yet to catch a single terrorist, beefed up border security units have refused entry to well-known activists, even while blocking the flow of pot from Canada to the U.S. According to an article appearing in Time magazine's August issue, seizures have doubled and redoubled since 2001 of pot on the border. There's significant increases in both apprehensions and narcotics seizures, said U.S. Border Patrol agent Senta Figueroa to the Bonner County Daily Bee in December. And she claimed that the more agents that were put up there, the more seizures that we'd see. Yet Canadian border services claim that the war on smuggling has begun to pay off. According to their statistics, there's been a 20% drop in major border busts in 2004 after a record peak in 2003. So in an interview with the Globe and Mail last December, RCMP Constable Alex Borden praised these anti-terrorism efforts, which had provided border police with equipment that allowed them to scan the handles of a briefcase or even air quality to determine the presence of mind-altering substances. Indeed, anti-terrorism funding has gone to purchase billions of dollars of equipment, the primary purpose of which has never been to find terrorists, but to find drugs. As the National Post warned last November, the Department of Homeland Security, supposedly founded to prevent terrorism, will be using their new high-tech air surveillance equipment, speedboats, and specially trained agents at five new air and marine bases to arrest Canadian pot smugglers. The first base along the BC border in Bellingham, Washington, has already opened, with a second scheduled for New Year's 2005 along the Quebec border in Plattsburgh, New York. More will follow near Detroit, Michigan, Grand Forks, BC, and Great Falls, Montana.
Grand Forks is one of the places?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
True terrorists must be laughing. Homeland Security will be so busy seizing pot that bombers and hijackers should have no problem getting over the border.
Hey, look over there. Someone's smuggling pot. Yeah. Quick, let's get this done. Let's get this dynamite over. Seriously.
I know, it's crazy. So meanwhile, while this is all going on, and they've got you know, people running after pot supposed terrorists all over the place, at 50 of the busiest official boarding crossings in the busiest official border crossings in 10 states, with borders against Canada and Mexico, the U.S. has begun fingerprinting and photographing most out-of-country visitors, as we heard rumored that
and
would
yeah,
happen.
Our friends are being subject to that. Not we were told foreign, and that means off North American soil. But I can tell you right now, most Canadians right now are getting the whole biometrics shakedown, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. It says they call the program U.S. Visit, and it says here that they're in Arizona, California, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, New Mexico, New York, Texas, Vermont, and Washington. And the fingerprints and photos will be matched with federal criminal record databases. And apparently the only people who are exempt are people who have a special U.S. visit card pass thing. So, yeah, if you're Canadian or Mexican, you're entering the states, prepare to be photographed and fingerprinted.
Yeah, and the thing is that the fingerprinting thing is just a stopgap measure. They want to, in 2 years, have the retinal scan dialed.
Yeah.
The thumb is just quick right now till they can get all the equipment in. It's wild.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And so, you know, if you're in the pot business at all, then this, you know, I mean, or if you've ever been busted for pot or anything like that, then this could be a major thing for you. You know, if you've even been busted once for smoking a joint, then you could, you know, they could conceivably get the records from Canada, because now the databases are totally linked.
Totally linked.
And just say, no, you're not in. You're not coming in.
I can tell you right now that if you are someone with a criminal record planning to go to the States and you don't like the idea of getting a biometric shakedown, a thumbprint, a digital photo, signature, then you shouldn't go, because you will undoubtedly go through that process. Doesn't matter how far back your criminal record is. They're shaking down everybody. Anybody who's remotely suspicious has to go through this procedure, or they won't be allowed in.
Yeah, totally.
At all. And if you refuse, you might be a terrorist.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, if you really want to get paranoid, here's an even more paranoid thought.
Oh, God. Dan, brace your campers.
Well, you know, I mean, like, say that you were in any way, say you'd visited a friend's place, and he had a bag of pot sitting on his counter or something like that, and you picked up the bag and you rolled a joint out of it, and then he went across the border with the bag and they fingerprinted it and they found your prints on it, that could be a reason to keep you out of the States. So it gets even more twisted than...
Okay, I'll tell you, I'll go even one further level. Under the new Patriot Act, they can hold you as a terrorist indefinitely without a trial. So how about that? You could be going over, you might have had breakfast with Abu Shaki Shamil from, you know, your Iranian friend from high school, and all of a sudden you're like going over, you have a possession, you get brought in, they're like, he might be a terrorist, you get held in jail for your whole life. Yeah, without man. A trial.
Yeah, man, those guys don't know the difference between a sheik and a little bit of shake, you know what I'm saying?
No, yeah, shake, sheik, you could be, you're going down. Yeah, seriously, like, you can be held indefinitely. Like, what kind of country is that where there's no process? You can be held indefinitely until they decide to let you go. And they don't have to have a trial, they don't have to release documents, they don't even have to tell your family that you're in there. So anyway, Dan, we're not going on holidays anytime soon. We're going to be visiting the Arctic.
Yeah, really.
We're hoping we're going to get our snowshoes and go snowboarding in the Arctic. No, but like, we can only go up and around.
Well, there's a lot of crazy stuff that's going on. And I mean, when you look at this kind of stuff, you realize that, you know, it's really more than just what they say it is, you know. I mean, they're spending billions of dollars on border security that they even admit themselves is being used to catch people who are smuggling in pot, or even just carrying in pot, or anybody who's been busted for a pot offense anywhere. And it has nothing to do with terrorism. They haven't caught a single terrorist, and they continue to beef it up and beef it up. And half of the money is going to equipment that's really specialized for catching drug smuggling, you know, and especially pot smugglers.
So I would even up your argument one step and to say this, that terrorism became such a tag word and such a tag idea that they attached activists, environmental activists, social activists, drug activists, drug smugglers, lesbians, gays, you know, anybody you could attach to that terrorism label, they put it on there.
Right,
and then
like
that way they could subjugate them, torture them, and lump them all in.
Well, it's all one issue in their minds. That's the whole thing about that DEA exhibit, right? They got this collage. And another part of the exhibit, they had a blown up a Thunderbird that had exploded, and they said it was a Thunderbird that belonged to some drug traffickers. And, you know, then they took all these mannequins that looked like human bodies, and they placed them like little kids and like a mother, all they've been dead or something,
God.
All around this car. And then you know, and then they had this chunk of metal and twisted stuff from the towers collapsing. And then they had this collage of Bin Laden with, like, you know, people smoking pot and, you know, like the planes hitting the buildings and all that crazy stuff, right? So it's like, you know, it's really obviously like they're trying to make this strong mental connection here. And I mean, you know, but, you know, we can, another interesting thing that just came up recently, and it was just after I kind of put that information together, was that the U.S., has recently gotten in big trouble. I guess Bush and his guys have gotten in, well, relative trouble. How much trouble can they really get in? It sort of runs off
their
back.
They're war criminals who go about their way unmolested.
But to get to the point, the General Accounting Office basically ruled that in two cases that the Office of National Drug Control Policy had produced illegal propaganda. That was basically classified as illegal covert propaganda. That basically what they'd done is they'd taken and created fake press, like news reports that they had given to major broadcasting companies throughout the U.S. And then these broadcasting companies had actually aired these supposed news reports. Well, it turns out that the journalist is a retired journalist. He was hired by the ONDCP, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, to produce these fake news reports, which were saying how the U.S., how the White House is going to step up its attack on pot and on pot users and pot dealers.
Oh, my God.
It's hilarious. And last year, I mean, this is something else that happened last year that we should bring up, too, is that the Office of National Drug Control Policy announced that it was going to stop focusing its attacks on hard drugs. It was going to focus from here on in on cannabis much more.
Oh, God.
Because they decided that cannabis was a greater risk than cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, speed, and other drugs.
It just so happens that they're in Afghanistan. That's surprising. And gee whiz, they just doubled. We'll find out later on in the show, but they just doubled the amount of military assistance that they're giving to Colombia. And we'll find out later how that all ties in with a horrific, horrific forecoming invasion.
Well, they doubled the number of U.S. troops there last fall, and it was hardly reported in the press.
Yeah.
But something that's interesting, you mentioned Afghanistan, is that the number of opium poppies growing there has something like doubled.
It's 86%.
It was like
more heroin.
Exactly.
In the
so
markets.
This is the thing, is that under the Taliban, before the U.S. invaded, the Taliban government had been growing a certain amount of poppies there, but the U.S. had said, hey, like, if you guys can grow less, then, you know, we'll give you some special deal, some special aid and stuff like that. So the Taliban actually did grow less, but it seemed to me more like a ploy, because what happened is they disaffected their grassroots support, and that's when the U.S. invaded, and then they didn't have any support because they'd been pissing off the farmers with, you know, all these restrictions on opium growing, and then since they got rid of the Taliban, now they're growing almost twice as much.
I would say it differently. I would say that they had the same amount of opium production, but in regions where there was more U.S. support and less Taliban support. You know what I mean? They were able to bomb certain fields so that in other areas the production would go up, in areas where there'd be more support against the Taliban. Do you know what I mean?
Like, the thing is that if you really want to talk about funding terrorism, marijuana doesn't really play a role in that. It's more heroin and cocaine that plays a role in that.
Oh, yeah.
And those are the two things that the U.S. government also makes money on. So why are they attacking cannabis? It doesn't make sense, except for it does make sense because that's where they're getting all their dollars from. And the terrorists might be getting their dollars there, too, but... Man, the American government is making more money off of cocaine and heroin than those terrorists ever will. And the focus on cannabis is just an excuse to go after their own people in a psychop war against their own people to destroy their freedoms so they can have control of everybody.
Ah!
Yeah.
You can't stop us now. We never stop. We'll keep puffing down.
A war for gold, a war for money, and a war for souls. A war on terror, a war on drugs, a war on kindness, a war on hugs. A war on birds and a war on bees. They got a war on hippies trying to save the trees. A war with jets and a war with missiles. A war with high-seated government officials. Wall Street war on high finance. A war on people who just love to dance. A war on music, a war on speech. A war on teachers and the things they teach. A war for the last 500 years. War's just messing up the atmosphere. A war on Muslims, a war on Jews, a war on Christians and Hindus. A whole lot of people saying kill them all. They got a war on Mumia, Abu Jamal. The war on pop is a war that's fair. A war that's filling up the nation's jails. World War 1, 2, 3, and 4. Chemical weapons, biological war. Bush War 1 and Bush War 2. They got a war for me, they got a war for you. We can't stop it when the beat just drops. We can't stop it with the Red Bull. To the new day, round to the new day, transform hell into heaven, God lives through, grab hold of today, yesterday is over, tomorrow may be too late, everything is one, but the one is unbalanced, music made full of dollar, like soul and talent, really ain't it all about a feeling you was having as a child, running wild before the mind programming, set in threatening,
your establishment,
getting this energy,
lay back and see,
the next man wrecking,
till the masses
lay, they head brethren,
get to asking,
we'll win, Mr. President,
what do you know,
it's evident, setting in slow,
how does it go,
an unprecedented event is about to unfold, the devil can't start, won't start blocking the globe, pulling the sound here. Freedom come knock at the door. They try locking it though, but we about to explode. We got the firefly tiger, eye apocalypse flow. So deep in the bottom of your bottomless soul. Sin mind yards flying out without a pistol. Redesign lost minds got out of the cold. Bring order to a world that is out of control. Truth, you say, I say, how do I know?
We can't stop when the beat just drops. We can't stop with the Red Bull rock. We can't stop until we hit those heights.
Because I love punk rock, I wanna rock with heads. Because I love hip hop, I wanna rock my beats all around the block. If I was in Baghdad, then I would rock, I rock. I wanna rock with punk, because I love punk rock. I wanna rock with heads, because I love hip hop. I wanna rock my beats all around the block. There's just one love, so the planet will rock. Yeah. New world days and new world nights. New world wrong and new world rights. Putting new world funds in the new world banks. With the new world guns on the new world tanks. New world devils and new world gods. New world jails, even new world's heart. New world names, sing new world songs. New world planes are the new world laws. New world's flying, the new world's dying. The new world's crying, the new world's trying. New world sons and new world daughters. They're already selling us new world water. New world beats for the new world to bang. New world streets for the new world to hang. New world president, new world drugs. New world resident, new world thugs. New world players for new world sports. New world trials for new world courts. New world lawyers and new world laws. New world prisons and new world bars. New world fight, the new world fist. New world lighting up the new world split. New world smoke and the new world burns. New world smoke and the new world split.
We can't stop it when the beat just drops. We can't stop it when the Red Bull rocks. We can't stop it till we hit those heights. We can't stop it because we love this life. We can't stop it when the beat just drops.
We don't stop.
We don't
don't stop.
Kootenai Co-op Radio never stops pumping out the truth. This is Fane of the Cosmos, and this is Bad Cop No Donut.
Welcome to our first show of the new year. This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of January 6th, 2005.
All right, please, please.
Bad Cop No Donut.
Bad, 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 bad.
Cop, 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 cop.
No, 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 no. Donut, 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 donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. A police sergeant in Dayton, Ohio, is facing three charges relating to his hiring of an officer with a record of sexual misconduct with children. Sergeant Rally Barnett was charged on December 22nd after a probe which revealed that he had hired Alan Peace, an officer who was accused of sexually abusing an 11-year-old last January. Peace was arrested for sexual abuse and resigned from the department in early December. Peace had only been on the force for 1 week. He had also served as an officer for a short time in Lincoln Heights, Ohio, after which he resigned for an unknown reason in early 2004. Sergeant Barnett has been charged with one felony count of misuse of confidential information and two misdemeanor charges, first-degree official misconduct and failure to report child sexual abuse. The police chief in Mulberry, Florida, has been suspended for 3 days without pay. Chief Alan Graham's suspension, which began on Wednesday, was the result of an investigation which looked at allegations that he made racist remarks, provided printouts of government documents to civilians, and improperly voided 4 traffic tickets. His suspension will ultimately cost him around $500. A police officer in Jamestown, New York, pleaded not guilty at his arraignment on 12 stalking, harassment, and official misconduct charges earlier this week. Officer Michael Watson was arrested in October, and a grand jury handed down the 12 charges last week. Watson has been accused of stalking and harassing 3 women between September 2002 and August 2004. Officer Watson has been identified as a person of interest in the case of a missing mother of 4 who disappeared in August. A man in Steubenville, Ohio, filed a lawsuit in federal court this week accusing the police department of unjustly arresting and beating him. The man was attempting to get into his parents' home late one night when he was restrained and arrested by officers John Lellis and Edward Kurovich. In the lawsuit, the man claims that the officers then beat him in the face and head. He was charged with underage drinking, but that charge was later dropped by a judge in court. The man, who claims that Steubenville police have a long history of civil rights violations, is seeking over $2 million in damages. Police shot a woman driving a van after a bar fight in Fredericksburg, Virginia on Monday. The woman was shot after police tried to break up a bar fight and a crowd of observers turned against them. The woman then got into her van and drove at the officers before 2 of them fired at her. Police say the woman is in stable condition at a local hospital. This is the 4th shooting by area police in less than 5 months. On August 16th, a man was shot by 2 police officers on the same block after he allegedly took one of their weapons during a struggle. On December 2nd, a man was shot and killed by sheriff's deputies after a confrontation at the man's psychiatrist's office. On December 20th, a sheriff's deputy shot and stabbed a man in his squad car while he was being transported to a local jail. The officers involved in all of the cases, except the most recent, have already been cleared of any wrongdoing by their departments. Police in San Mateo County, California, killed 2 people in separate incidents last weekend. One man was repeatedly tasered by officers in Pacifica after his family called for help when the man became disoriented and was having trouble breathing. Police say the man was combative and uncooperative. The man's family has another version of events. They say that by the time police arrived, the man was calm and that they refused to allow the officers to enter the house. When the man stood up and placed his hand on his head, he was rushed by officers who threw him face down on the ground and repeatedly tasered the man when he was already unable to move. When the man's father objected, police used a stun gun on him twice and took him outside the house. Hours earlier, police in nearby Redwood City shot and killed a man who was brandishing a machete. His family had also called police for help in dealing with the man. Two Broward County, Louisiana sheriff's deputies are under arrest after it was discovered that they closed cases by attributing crimes to people who couldn't possibly have committed them. Detectives Chris Thyman and Christian Zapata are accused of fraudulently clearing cases to make their statistics look better. The two have been suspended without pay. In one case, Thyman was accused of attributing 8 robberies to a prisoner who refused to speak with the detective without his lawyer present. In a report, Thyman claimed that the man had confessed to the robberies. In another case, a woman was accused by Thyman of confessing to stealing a guitar. The report, which detailed her confession, was dated days before the robbery was reported to police. Thyman also signed off on a report which claimed that a teenager had confessed to a 2002 car robbery. It was later discovered that the teen was in police custody at the time the crime was committed. Thyman is facing 8 felony counts of misconduct, which carry a maximum sentence of 5 years each. Zapata had attributed at least a dozen crimes to a 13-year-old boy, including a car theft that happened while he was in class at a private school he attended. Zapata is charged with 14 counts of official misconduct. The charges follow a county-wide investigation, which is expected to yield further arrests of police officers in the future. 5 other officers were fired in October 2003 when the investigation was initiated. A police officer in Providence, Rhode Island, is on trial starting this week for assaulting 2 women who were arguing with a female acquaintance of his. Officer David Ramage was suspended without pay in October when he was charged with 2 counts of simple assault. The women were involved in an argument with Ramage's friend after their car mirrors scraped each other in a parking lot. In the end, Officer Ramage gave one woman a broken wrist and the other a black eye. A federal appeals court ruled last week that a girl who was handcuffed by Tuscaloosa, Alabama police has the right to sue for use of excessive force. The 10-year-old girl was handcuffed by Deputy Antonio Bostich after she had an argument with her gym teacher over whether or not she had completed her jumping jacks. Bostich left the department in November. The city of Albany, New York, is changing its policy to restrict police officers from firing their weapons at moving vehicles. There is no timetable for the implementation of the policy, but it is believed that the change is due to the death 1 year ago of an innocent bystander who was killed by a stray police bullet. Police in Jacksonville, Florida, are facing a new accusation of brutality. A man claims he was beaten and abused outside a nightclub by Jacksonville police on Christmas Eve after he couldn't comply with their request to leave the area because he had locked his keys in his car. The man says he was pulled out of his friend's car by the officers, who had not asked him to step out of the vehicle. Officers proceeded to twist his arm, knee him in the back, and pull his hair before taking him to jail. The man suffered a broken wrist and was later treated at a hospital. The man has sought assistance from the NAACP. Police in Jacksonville are under fire from the people they are paid to protect and serve because of the recent deaths of 2 black men in police custody. On New Year's Day, hundreds of demonstrators marched in Jacksonville to protest the deaths. One man was killed by a police officer on December 3rd after he was arrested for drinking a beer outside of his home. Another man died in Jacksonville police custody after he was pepper sprayed and restrained during an arrest on December 5th. Both the FBI and the United States Attorney's Office are investigating the deaths. A police officer in Linton, Indiana, has resigned after being suspended. Officer Mike Tatlock was suspended from the Indiana Police Academy for 30 days on December 16th because of an undisclosed act of misconduct. He was subsequently suspended from the Linton Department for 30 days as a result of his academy suspension. In his letter of resignation, Officer Tatlock claims to be leaving the force for personal reasons. A police officer in Lincoln, Illinois, who was found to have marijuana growing in her basement, appeared in court last Wednesday for her arraignment. Officer Diana Short resigned this week rather than face a dismissal hearing scheduled for 2 weeks from now. She was suspended without pay last week. Short is facing 5 years in prison and a $50,000 fine if she is convicted of unlawful manufacture of marijuana. The officer is facing a further 3 years and $20,000 if convicted of growing between 5 and 20 marijuana plants. She may also face official misconduct charges and fraud charges related to lying about her age in order to obtain a driver's license when she was 15 years old. 2 police officers in Chattanooga, Tennessee have been fired and another suspended for use of excessive force. Officers Stephen Miller and Daniel Gibbs were both fired last Thursday after they were charged with assaulting a homeless man. Officer Ray Brantis was suspended for 28 days without pay. He's accused of beating two men after a chase. Brantis was also placed on probation for 1 year. It was determined that he used excessive force and failed to file the appropriate report about the incident. Two Pennsylvania police officers have pleaded guilty to corruption charges in separate cases. Former Lansford Police Chief Joseph Stariowski pleaded guilty to illegal sale of firearms, including a machine gun. An officer from nearby Coaldale, Michael Weaver, pleaded guilty to civil rights charges after he and another officer, Jerry Summers, planted cocaine on a suspect. Summers is scheduled to plead guilty on January the 20th. Police in Detroit shot a man on Tuesday after he pulled his hands out of his pockets during a confrontation with police. The man, who is in serious condition in hospital, was unarmed at the time of the shooting. A teenager died in Naples, Florida last week after police shot him with a taser. The 19-year-old was the third person to die last month after being shot with a stun gun by Florida police officers. The man's father, who saw him at the hospital before he was pronounced dead, said that his son appeared to be severely beaten and suffering from many injuries. The teenager, who was not armed and has no criminal record, was a passenger in a car stopped by police for a minor traffic infraction. Police claim the man got out of the back seat of the car and attacked them. The police used both a taser and a substance similar to pepper spray called Capstun to subdue the man. The use or misuse of Capstun and similar products by police is a growing problem, so much so that its manufacturer, DuPont, issued a warning about the dangers of direct application of the substance, adding that the compound was untested for skin and eye irritancy and sensitization to animals. The document warned in bold letters that contact with the skin and eyes should be avoided. But the memo apparently never made it to many North American police departments, who continue to spray the products directly at those they are sworn to protect and serve, fairly indiscriminately. More frightening is that products claiming to be much more potent than Capstun are now available for police use. Police use of tasers is also coming under increased scrutiny. An Amnesty International report on the use of tasers in Canada and the U.S., which was released on November 30th, documented 74 deaths linked to the use of stun guns. Since that time, the number appears to have increased substantially. Stun guns manufactured by Taser International use a 50,000-volt shock to subdue people in a supposedly non-lethal fashion. The stun guns are used by thousands of police departments across North America, and judging by the company's 2004 sales figures, their use will continue to grow.
They killed him. They murdered him. I went back over to the corner, and I said, "That's my son. Let me see him. Let me go to him." And they said, "No, you can't go over there." And he had blood all over his face, and he was just laying there. If you look at the cars, where can you see the ram marks? There's no skid marks over there. There's no dents in the police car. There's no dent in his car. They could have done something else to stop him instead of shooting him. I mean, they shot him in the head, the chest, the stomach.
Other than the killings already mentioned, police also killed people this week in the following cities: San Antonio, Texas, where police killed a robbery suspect; Toronto, Ontario, where a 17-year-old robbery suspect was killed by police on New Year's Eve; Skagtacoke, New York, where police killed a man after a domestic dispute; Kansas City, Missouri, where police killed a man during a New Year's Eve standoff at a McDonald's restaurant; Ontario, California, where police killed a man after an illegal street race; Portland, Oregon, where police killed a 24-year-old man who had stolen a truck; East Chicago, Indiana, where police killed a 44-year-old man who had been in an argument with his sister; Grand Prairie, Texas, where police killed a mentally ill 34-year-old man; and Santa Clara, California, where police killed a 22-year-old who was being pulled over for a minor traffic infraction, making the man the third person killed by Bay Area police last weekend alone. Email your comments and story ideas to ihatepigs@hotmail.com. That's all for now. Be sure to tune into this station for more next week. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Each week we end Bad Cop No Donut with a song about the police. This week it's "So You Want to Be a Cop" by Leftover Crack.
I don't care if we fill the jails, arrest anyone, any rank.
We will make them see their injustice, and it will hurt, as all fighting hurts. But we cannot lose. We
of the next generation, and you get the high fives at the polling station.
So you wanna wear blue and pray on the people, come loose the Constitution, or all men so equal. Beat down the poor and the working class core. You're a class grade among the fucking rich man whore.
Cause there's a thin blue line between the love and the hate. If you don't choose to cross it, you're a Nazi for the state. You're unjust, precious, the precious to few. So you wanna be a killer from the red, white, and blue.
You don't get to the ground, cause you're always down. Nothing's on attack when you become the sex. You're your own damn brother, you got no respect. But the killer won't stop when you become a god. What better matter, and it ain't gonna stop. It's another man on the way. So we reach the top of the battle at the rhythm, what's your detail? You got a picture of society and it's a will.
Even the drama, such a racist situation lies.
You got the upper hand in a war with a trigger when you're on to the loose of pride.
Wanna be a cop? Never stop you with your guns going pop, pop, pop. 41 shots, you're grinning in the door shop. Your sickening behavior regulates this society. Yeah. You muster all the sickness and hit your head inside of me.
So you wanna wear blue? Well, you're just a type. Got a chip on your shoulder and an itch for a crime. Standing on a raft in an ocean of blood, but you're doing the killing and you cop your gun.
How can we tolerate this man? A piece of paper, you cop. Never cycle to his death, you in the shower. Choking game, morning G, LOC, never stop. And you just to be sweet if you wanna be a cop.
Safety is green and the sky is blue. Well, that's about right, cause we'll be low. Can you come an extra attitude when you call them a blind?
So you wanna be a cop?
What does it matter, man? It ain't gonna stop. If you come to mind, come on, we do it. Better as there is rough risk. What you should feel. You got a vision for society and it's your will.
Even the drama, some can make it. Think you wait to die.
You got the upper end of the wall. When you drink away your eyes, you're going to be surprised.
Is to provoke response, and we will continue to provoke until they respond or they change the law.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicoopradio.com. And if you're one of the listeners who are over the great waters, you're listening on 96.5 FM Kootenai Lake. Now, we've been talking about how the war on drugs is used as a huge psychops. Well, it's used also on, like, there's different levels. For us, we are the users and the people, but there's the people in other countries who are the producers, the indigenous peoples who grow the coca leaves or grow the opium poppies, and their psychops is even more heinous. This is the reason I want to cover Colombia is just, for one, because of its importance in the whole psychops game, the use of drugs as a way for the United States to enter a country and take it over, and also the fact that Venezuela, which is starting to be more of an alternative kind of country, Colombia is the way the United States intends to invade Venezuela. It won't be Iran, folks. In a previous publication, this is from zmag.org, which is where I get a lot of ideas. There's a lot of brilliant writers, Fisk, Chomsky, a lot of them, that is their internet outlet, is on zmag.org.
This is called Colombia, a shill proxy, a shill country for us, intervention in Venezuela. In a previous publication, we discussed U.S. attempts to topple President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela through various agencies within the country, aided and abetted by external U.S. monetary and international and organizational support. In the past few years, one coup d'etat by the Venezuelan army, four general strikes to disrupt this economy, and a recall referendum on August 15, 2004, which allows a president to be removed from his or her office after midterm, have failed. Now the imperialist forces are left with a few avenues of toppling him. One of them is a military intervention, on some excuses and through a shill or proxy country. But what excuses and which country? The two most likely ones are war on terrorism, counterinsurgency, and the war on drugs. And the country likely to spearhead the military intervention is Colombia, a neighbor of Venezuela, struggling to defeat its own internal revolutionary armed forces of Colombia, FARC, and others who control a considerable part of Colombia. Today, Colombia has received the largest amount of U.S. military aid in Latin America. The aid has grown tenfold since 1995. Since 2003, there are 800 U.S. military trainers and 600 civilian contractors. The U.S. has already provided $3 billion in military aid to Colombians. To Colombia in the past 3 years. An armada of 60 U.S.-made Huey 2 and Black Hawk attack helicopters are the main weapons brought for quick deployment of Colombian troops in FARC-controlled southern Colombia to provide security for the planes doing aerial spraying of drug crops, coca plants. To protect the pipelines owned by the U.S.-based Occidental Petroleum in Arauca Department province on the land of indigenous Uwa tribe. Is that right, Dan?
That's right.
A $98 million aid was given in 2002 for the purchase of 12 surveillance and attack helicopters. Occidental has been spent years lobbying for military assistance in Colombia. In July 2002, another $35 million was allocated for operation in Peru and areas of Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil, where drug smugglers presumably operate. Colombia. Some of the background. Let's just see. Okay.
You know that thing with the UWA, Dustin? That's pretty intense. Like,
that's huge.
Those people are like totally peaceful, nonviolent people, and they protested at one point some oil development that was happening on their land, and their response was the military and the Occidental workers who were driving bulldozers drove peaceful protesters, which included women and children, into a river. Actually, came at them with bulldozers and equipment with guns, and forced them into the river where several children drowned to death. Like, I guess if you drown, you die. But yeah, it's like they killed them,
totally.
They murdered them.
If you look at Colombia, there was in 1948, Jorge Eliezer Gaitan, leftist populist mayor of Bogota, was assassinated, and there was a period of violence from 1948 to 1958 called La Violencia. Armed rebels operating in Colombia were known as the FARC. Well, enter the multinational corporations. By 1970, a large number of multinational corporations, mostly from the U.S., had billions invested in Colombia. The multinationals were Petroleum and Natural Gas Reserves, Exxon Mobil, Occidental, Canon Lehman, British Petroleum. Coal mines were the Drummond Company, Birmingham, Alabama, Coca-Cola with 17 plants employing 10,000 workers, banana exporting companies like Chiquita, Dole, and Del Monte. Dole bought 20% of Colombia's flour industry and is now the largest single exporter of fresh-cut Colombian flowers. Throughout Colombia, indigenous tribes, peasants, small cultivators, and small miners stand in the way of oil drilling, pipeline laying through Indian tribal lands, agro-businesses, and large-scale mining that causes dispossession of land and environmental damage. Revolutionary peasants and indigenous organizations developed armed resistance and disrupted the operations of the multinationals. Between 1982 and 1999, there were more than 600 guerrilla attacks on the pipelines, with 1.6 million barrels of oil spilled along the way. In 2001, the pipeline was bombed 170 times and was out of commission for 266 days, cutting heavily into Occidental's company's profits. It became obvious that to safeguard the multinational corporation's investments and profits, U.S. military protection and security was required. So they used the peasants as an excuse to come in and for the U.S. to give the country funding. But the second excuse was drugs. During the post-Vietnam years, drug use, primarily recreational, began to increase in the U.S., and so did the drug cocaine, which is exported from Colombia. Drug barons, in conjunction with large landlords, controlled the expanding cocaine production and trade, reaping windfall profits. U.S. and Colombian media and diplomatic sources have steadfastly maintained that it is the revolutionary groups, FARC and the ELN, and not the paramilitary that finances its operations through drugs. However, a report by Klaus Needle, the representative in Colombia of the United Nations Drug Control Program, told reporters on May 8, 2001, that right-wing paramilitary are indeed involved in drug trafficking, even more than the guerrillas of the FARC, to such an extent that there are regions of the country in which it is hard to tell who are the drug traffickers and who are the paramilitary. Although the rebels finance their war with taxes on the drug trade, Needle said, we do not consider the FARC drug traffickers. We believe that it's still a matter of guerrilla organization with political objectives, and the ELN never has been very involved in drug trafficking, quote unquote. So we begin to see the U.S. start giving aid to Colombia. This included biochemical and bacteriological warfare against the peasants, and it basically hit full force in 1998. DynCorp, a defense contractor and a Fortune 500 company, has a $600 million contract to carry out aerial spraying to eliminate coca crops, which contaminate the food, the water. Glyphosate, which is what they use, which is the Roundup, is, you know, in our country is banned from being used on people or from aerial spraying, but here, well, not aerial spraying, but like you can't spray it on people, but in Colombia it's regular kind of thing, and it destroys the water sources. So here we have the multinational corporations. They're in Colombia, here's the revolutionaries, but then Venezuela's progressive populist policies, they also pose a major threat to this imperialistic folk and their allies in Latin America. A victory for even a modus vivendi with the revolutionary forces in Colombia, along with Venezuela's successful policies, are likely to present an alternative to the socioeconomic model spawned by the World Bank, the IMF, and the multinational corporations. This momentum has had to be defeated by military force if necessary, and Chavez has to go. If Colombia is to be secured for these multinational corporations. Coups and strikes failed to topple Chavez. With his victory at the recall referendum on August 15, 2004, he's emerged a bigger threat than before for imperialists and its subalterns in Latin America. Venezuela presents an example for other indebted and exploited countries of Latin America countries to take charge of their nations for its people. In the wake of his referendum victory, Chavez called on the country's private business operators to work with his government in moving the country away from capitalism. He stated, quote, we have to eliminate large landholding in Venezuela. What we have done so far has been very, very superficial. Everybody expects Chavez to get tougher and deepen the revolution. These are threatening words for those who follow the U.S., World Bank, IMF, leading in establishing a capitalist, free enterprise, for-profit economic order. And Colombia has affirmed to follow these IMF, World Bank policies. Now, what could be the grounds for intervention? Venezuela and Colombia share a common, semi-porous, 1,370-mile border where drug trafficking, kidnapping, and smuggling are common. Since 2003, there have been several incursions by Colombian paramilitary forces into Venezuela's western provinces of Zulia and Táchira. killing civilians and National Guard troops, both as provocation and as a threat. In July 2003, Chavez ordered an additional 2,700 troops to reinforce security, in addition to the 20,000 already posted along the Colombian border. In 2001, the U.S. State Department put two Colombian revolutionary groups, FARC and the ELN, on terrorist list, accusing them of drug trafficking, smuggling, disrupting country's democratic process, and sabotaging the country's economy. U.S. also charged that Venezuela facilitates Middle Eastern terrorists to enter U.S. via Venezuelan territory. In contrast, in 2004, U.S. removed Colombian paramilitary force, which has been had one of the worst human rights records recorded and has been on the list for the past 3 years. This gives the U.S. military a clean sheet to supply paramilitary in Colombia with arms. And grounds are also being laid on a political, ideological level. In 2004, in his annual posture statement, U.S. Southern Commander General James Hill identified radical populism, i.e. Venezuela, and gangs, revolutionary guerrillas, as major dangers facing the region. At the same time, a new doctrine called effective sovereignty was developed by the Bush administration, which contends that the U.S. national security is threatened by Latin American governments' failure to exercise control over the ungoverned spaces, such as the Amazon Basin, which invites unlawful elements of societies. This doctrine permits U.S. to intervene in other countries to protect and maintain its security, and permits a steady flow of weapons and military personnel for this region. In fact, attempts to foment a revolt/coup started 3 months prior to Chavez's referendum victory in August 2004. In May 2004, about 120 members of the Colombian paramilitary, wearing Venezuelan military uniform, landed clandestinely near Venezuelan capital to link up with other anti-national groups and disgruntled unions within the country to foment revolt, sabotage, and help remove Chavez. Most of them were apprehended by local police. Because of these developments, Venezuela reduced its military ties with Washington. To strengthen its security, in November 2004, it ordered 100,000 Russian semi-automatic rifles, anti-tank guns, 40 helicopters, and 50 MiG-29 MST warplanes. November 2004, there was an assassination of Venezuelan judicial prosecutor Danilo Anderson, who was prosecuting 2002 coup leaders. There was assassination of high officials, and so we're beginning to see that none of these methods or tactics have ever worked and have not deposed Chavez. Hence, a military intervention is anticipated. Early in 2004, Colombia agreed to buy 46 tanks from Spain equipped with 120mm guns and its accompanying shells, which, according to one security official, are clearly targeted against Chavez, particularly in the border area. The form the war is likely to take would be where Colombian military and paramilitary attack border communities, which Venezuelan army would repel. This would then be presented as Venezuelan aggression against Colombia, and the U.S. would help Colombia repel aggression and take over the war. At the same time, due to Colombian internal conditions, protests and demonstrations have grown in intensity and density, which have engaged much of Colombia's military and paramilitary forces, and hence they may find it difficult to mount an incursion other than the border engagements by paramilitary forces. In this context, the Colombian President Álvaro Uribe, the only South American leader to back Bush's invasion on Iraq, has invited Americans to invade Colombia, which should present several opportunities to intervene in Venezuela, and the newly re-elected war president, as Bush calls himself, will certainly seize the first opportunity to do so. So, I've been reading from an article called Colombia, a Shill Country for Us, Intervention in Venezuela. And that's because, for one thing, I don't know about you, Dan, but I love countries that are opposed to capitalism and set their sights on a different mode of existence than what we're used to, with Chavez wanting to institute a nationwide cooperative, food cooperatives, cooperative neighborhoods, community financial plans, that kind of thing. And I really support those initiatives in other countries, because you have to be brave to go against the capitalist monster.
Well, there's always a tendency to kind of favor the underdog anyways, especially when you are kind of the underdog yourself, you know. But I think also that you're, you know, when you take a look at what's happened in Venezuela, there's powerful moneyed interests there that have been trying to depose Chavez for some time. And there's been this whole process that went down there where there was an attempted coup, as you read, and you know, the coup failed, and Chavez was, by popular support, it failed. You know, there was a military coup, and the people rose up and said no, and he was put back in power.
Yeah, he was put back into power. That's so beautiful.
And then the U.S. went to the Organization of American States, the OAS, and tried to have Chavez, I guess the election or something, declared invalid or something like that. They said, no, it's good. And then, you know, they tried to do a
recall referendum
and get rid of him, and that didn't work.
60%.
Because the people love him too much.
Well, the thing is, he's speaking out for peasants and indigenous peoples, and for the idea of going against capitalism, which is kind of revolutionary, and I think is tastier on the tongue of people who live in the jungle and are more like on the land, you know.
Well, I don't know if he's totally against capitalism, because I've heard him actually even accused of being a libertarian to some degree. I'm not sure that really fits, you know, Hugo Chavez's profile very much. But he also wasn't really communist in the traditional sense of like Fidel Castro, where it's kind of like you do what I say or I kill you.
I'm just trying to look. He uses a one guy. I can't actually remember the guy's name now. His role model.
Well, what's really cool is he actually allows people to speak out. He allows dissent in his country. He allows these rich buffoons to try and remove him all the time and take over the country and sell out all of its resources to the U.S. He allows these things to happen because he honestly believes in some form of real democracy, and he also believes in his own popular support. And but he allows capitalism to happen in this country. There are businesses running, and everything isn't government owned. He hasn't seized the property. He's just more of a populist.
He's moving towards changing that, though. Like, the reason he got in was because he really touched the hearts of those people who are like, they want to get, like, you're right, there's multinational corporations in Venezuela. I mean, Venezuela is the second largest exporter of oil to the States, and so there is huge interest there, but he's trying to work it where more profits end up in the people's hands, you know?
Definitely. I totally see that as a good thing. I know he's probably moving away from the multinational format, you know, and he's doing it gently and slowly, but I don't think he's anti-business. I don't see him as like, you know, I just think he's more like, I think if you could characterize him as anything, sort of like a social libertarian, maybe. I don't know, it's kind of hard. I'd really have to study Chavez a lot more, but from what I know of him, he seems like a very, you know, he's very much for the people's rights, but he doesn't really come down as a hardcore communist at all,
mm-hmm.
which is really cool.
There's so few places in the world where it feels like people are actually making a concerted effort to get away from capitalism and to explore other modes of existence, other modes of survival, that I'm excited by things like that. I'm excited about Cuba. I'm excited about Argentina's changes that it's made. I'm excited about Chavez. I just, anywhere where there's the chance that there'll be a revolution, I gravitate towards it. I feel like that's a breath of fresh air for consciousness and for the expression, you know, the expression of freedom in the world.
I hear what you're saying, Dustin. It does seem like we don't have very much freedom. I don't know that a lot of these places have very much more freedom, though. Like I say, with Cuba, it's like you don't necessarily see a lot more freedom. But, you know, we should maybe go to a song.
Okay. What am I going to play here? Let's just see.
And maybe after the song we can talk about something like Grow Rippers, or we have the Terrence McKenna thing. Well, we'll decide.
I also have a narc
Anyway, we'll be right back.
We'll figure it out.
Welcome back. You're listening to Kootenai Corp Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson. And over the World Wide Web, if you're a digital listener, on www.kootenaicorpradio.com. And if you're in the Kootenai Lake area, it's 96.5 FM. This is Fate of the Cosmos. Damn.
So if you're trafficking in the States, you may want to bring a straw, just in case you get busted, because down in the States, according to the Knoxville News Sentinel, on Sunday, October 3rd, 2004, police have begun to seize gold teeth. So not only will you lose your house and your car, but you will lose that which you chew with. So you may want to have a straw.
What? How can they seize gold teeth?
Proceeds of crime.
Proceeds of crime. Fuck off.
Asset forfeiture.
No. What? Sorry, listeners. I did swear. I can't believe that they'll yank out your teeth as proceeds of crime.
That's what it said. That's what the article says. It also said that the, according to statistics, that the car of choice for drug traffickers isn't a Beamer, a Lexus, or even a fully loaded sports utility vehicle. They say that it's the modest Chevrolet Caprice. So all you drug traffickers out there driving Chevrolet Caprices, trade them in for something a little bit less noticeable.
A Caprice. Give me a break. Toyota Drug Runner.
But sort of back along the lines of that other thing that we were doing earlier, Bad Cop, No Donut, I was like, I was reflecting on, while I was listening to that, I was reflecting on the pregnant woman who was basically chased down, I think it was in down on the coast, and she was chased down, and she ended up running into a building, and both her and her baby died. And the police pulled her over and asked for her license, and well, the police officer in the car, she took off, and actually he'd recognized her for something, maybe some kind of an offense or something, and he chased her. And I mean, it's this kind of thing that you know, just this, it seems like a total lack of mercy in some ways, you know, and we become desensitized to it to the point where it's like we take it as routine that we should be pulled over for no reason at all on the side of a highway. It's all done under the pretext that, you know, that they're going to be looking at your license, but it's actually, you know, it's for other reasons. They're pulling you over, they're searching every car that comes down the road because they're hoping to catch you for whatever other thing that they may catch you for. And we know that's what they're doing, and yet we allow it. As a society, we allow it. We allow them to do something they're not supposed to do under the pretext of something that they're allowed to do. And that is fraud. That's known as fraud. In any other case, it's known as fraud. And so
listeners, there's only, when you're pulled over on a roadside, there's only four things that an officer can be looking for: whether or not you're impaired, whether or not your vehicle is safe, whether or not you have insurance, and whether or not you have a driver's license. That's it. That's it. Anything else is an investigation. And once you start an investigation, then you have to be read your rights. You have to know why you're being detained. So if an officer comes, asks to see your driver's license and your insurance, and he gives it back, and then he's like, smells like pot in here. You've been smoking pot? That's the start of the investigation, and that's when you say, I'd like to speak to my lawyer. Am I under arrest? And if he says, no, you're not under arrest, then you say, well, I have to go then, officer. I don't feel like being detained here. It's a very tricky thing, but you have to exert your rights. Never answer anything that doesn't have to do with your license, your insurance, your vehicle safety, or your sobriety. And I don't mean that when he asks you, have you smoked a joint, that you say yes. You just say, officer, are you conducting an investigation right now? That's my favorite line, and it'll always help you through times. Are you conducting an investigation right now? Because I would need to speak to my lawyer before I answered that question. That usually gets him pretty, you know, that gets him going. But stick to it, folks, because we can turn it into a psyops, a reverse sting, if we all are like super on our rights. So when they pull up to the, when we pull up to the road checks, they're like, you know, if we have savvy, it'll never get abused. It only gets abused when we let them stomp on us.
The other thing I always reflect on whenever I hear that bad cop, no donut thing is that
I just imagine this world where we don't have this horrible drug war. We don't have these horrible excuses to violate people in our society, that we actually tolerate people and we allow them the freedoms to do those things which don't harm anybody else. We just let people be and explore themselves and explore their identities. And in that world, the police are there to really to protect and serve. They're there to make sure that we're all okay. And we respect them because of that, you know.
We love them. Like, you would come up to the cop and give him a pat on the shoulder and be like, "Hey, buddy.
Like, right on.
How's it going today,
good
brother?
Job. Like, yeah.
Like, yeah. Well, how's it going? Right on. Yeah, okay, man. All right, well, have a good day. See you, brother. Woo!" You know, and you'd, like, shake hands. You'd give him a high five. You'd be like, "Right on, dude. Like, you're doing a really good job." But cops haven't garnered that respect.
Well, some of them do that, and that's good. And you know, and you can say that maybe most of them have done that at some point or another, or do it, you know, with a certain frequency. But it's this other stuff that wrecks that makes it hard for people to, you know, to give them the full respect that they
should have. For me, the respect thing, the way it gets diminished is when they beat on people. Really pisses me off, and I know it goes on in this town. When they bust people for soft crime, but let people doing hard crime go, or they abuse their position. That just, it drives me nuts. And that's why I don't have any respect. The main, the other form of disrespect I hate is when you talk to a cop man to man, woman to man, you know, as a civilian to a civilian, not as a person to a cop, and then they use that against you. I don't like that. And I've had it happen to me before, and I just hate that. When you're like man to man, you know, you're talking to someone, you're like, "Off the record, buddy, let's talk. Like, this is it, the way it's going. Like, what do you, you know, like, come on, like, let's be heart to heart." And then all of a sudden it's in court, and then he told me this, and then he told me that, and I'm like, we made an agreement, man. You know, that pisses me off.
Well, hey, why don't we play that Narco Paranoia Freakout session?
Okay. I just want to say one thing, though, folks. For Christmas, did I tell you? You know those mini crystal growing sets that you can get? You pour the crystals in? I got a crystal meth crystal growing set. It's a little Christmas tree, and you pour this liquid on, you add some water, and all of a sudden all these meth crystals started growing off it. I couldn't believe it.
Come on, that's good.
It's the crystal meth Christmas tree.
No,
I couldn't believe it.
That can't be true.
I'm not. You know those things, they grow crystals? This was a crystal meth one.
No.
You just add water, and the crystal meth crystals grow on the Christmas
tree.
Come
on, that can't be right.
I'm not kidding, man. Crystal meth crystal growing kit. I couldn't believe it. What a stocking stuffer.
I'm glad I didn't try any of the candy canes at your place.
Yeah, man, it was so wild. I'm still waiting for the LSD crystal Christmas tree kit.
Come on.
I hope it comes out soon.
Justin, that's it.
Okay, here's some Dark Alliance.
It's time to shut down the CIA.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
We'll do everything possible to reduce the serious threat to our society.
For a national crusade against drugs.
Our most serious problem today is cocaine, and in particular, crack.
The only thing I would say about that is we're in real trouble on that.
Who's responsible?
The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency.
The CIA is probably the largest drug dealer on Earth.
What is the relationship of the Central Intelligence Agency with international drug producers and distributors?
There has been a relationship between the increased flow and supply of drugs coming to the United States and CIA covert operations.
The alarming connection between drugs on our streets and U.S. covert operations abroad.
Who's responsible? Who's responsible? Let me tell you straight out.
What I found was that starting in the 70s in Peru, teenagers in middle-class neighborhoods started smoking this paste, this coca paste. And the scientists started writing about it because it turned them into, you know, the kinds of things you see in Reefer Madness, these drug zombies that would walk around and that's all they would think about was getting their next fix. And this was literally true.
Who's responsible?
They started warning the Americans at this conference in Lima in summer of 79. The South Americans got together with the North American science cocaine experts and said, look, you've got a problem coming. You need to do something about
it. Who's responsible?
And so the scientific community, led by Dr. Robert Bick of Yale, decided that this was a problem. And they this was a real problem. And so he went to Congress and told them that there was going to be a massive drug epidemic coming within the next few years. It had already ravaged Bolivia, it was ravaging Peru, it was ravaging Colombia, and he had never seen anything like it in his life. And there were a number of scientists in South America that were frightened about it.
Who's responsible? Who's responsible? Who's responsible?
He suggested that the Congress start a public education campaign to warn people that this stuff was coming and don't get anywhere near it. And they thanked him for his testimony and then said, well, you know, how do we stop the Bolivians from growing coca plants? And how do we stop the Peruvians from growing coca plants? And he said, well, you know, it'd be easier to stop growing tobacco in Virginia. It's just never going to happen.
Who's responsible?
But they ignored what he said, and they went on with this eradication strategy called the Andean strategy. And this is what we did. We tried to get people to stop growing plants. And crack came. And it first showed up in South Central Los Angeles, probably in the very late 70s. By 1982, drug users had perfected this to take it from freebasing, which was kind of dangerous to make, to this very safe, I think it was even called healthful, method of making it with baking soda and water. And it started catching on among the very rich celebrities. It started catching on among the very rich drug dealer because cocaine was so very expensive in the late 1970s and early 1980s. But when you turned it into crack, it became very cheap since you didn't need it. And the cocaine started showing up in greater and greater amounts in the streets of Los Angeles in the early 80s. The men who were running the market down in L.A., this fellow Danilo Blandone, he told the CIA that when he started this operation down there, he was paid a visit initially by Enrique Bermudez, who was the CIA agent. He was on the CIA payroll. There was a military commander of the Contras at the time, this army called the FDN. And at this meeting, he told the Inspector General of the CIA, Bermudez told them that he wanted them to adopt the flag of the FDN, he wanted them to adopt the colors of the FDN, and he said from that point on, we were part of the FDN. We used their flag, we used their colors, we used their letterhead, and, you know, I really don't know what more you need to do to become a Contra than to accept the offer from the head of the Contras. It's not like this guy was his brother or his cousin or something. So they were an official part of the FDN, and the FDN's role with the CIA was essentially a wholly owned subsidiary. I mean, they wrote the agreement, they picked the name, they picked the officers, they wrote the press releases, they told them to take credit for battles that they had nothing to do with. And this is all laid out in Edgar Chamorro's monograph. I think it's called Packaging the Contras, which is just a brilliant expose of what was going on inside the Contras at the time. So you had drug traffickers who were members of the FDN. And these men were meeting with CIA agents, and they took, in this case, in Dark Alliance, they took their fundraising orders directly from the CIA agent, Enrique Bermudez, and nobody has denied that. I mean, that is undisputed. Blandone, who was at the meeting, says it happened. Norwin Meneses, who was his boss, was also at the meeting, says it happened. Adolfo Calero says they had a meeting. Nobody's denying that this occurred. If you look at the history of the FDN, and which is what I did in the book, I tracked them back to their beginnings in Guatemala as the Legion of September 15. These guys were out there and they were involved in contract killings. They were involved in kidnappings for money. I mean, these were warriors and they didn't have a war to fight and they needed to have a way to make a living. So they robbed and they stole and they thieved. And the CIA looked at them and said, that's just the kind of organization we need. And so they signed them up.
It's time to shut down the CIA.
Norwin,
Philadelphia men cocaine traffickers have expanded their operations without fear of prosecution.
These covert operations seem to provide the extraordinary protection the traffickers often need.
All of this is justified in the name of national security.
Major drug smuggling on the part of the Contras. The Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, they were flying on the John Holmes Ranch.
Drugs being used to finance the CIA war against Nicaragua.
The CIA station chief and people in the National Security Council are banned for life for introducing cocaine trafficking to Costa Rica.
It's important to draw a distinction between what these traffickers contributed personally out of their own pockets and what this drug ring produced. And in my series, I said that this drug ring sent millions of dollars down. And I based that on Blandone's testimony initially. And it's been since come out in the CIA Inspector General's report. They interviewed two of the men who actually took them down there. One of them they interviewed after George Hodel and I interviewed him, in which he said he took down, I think it was between $4 and $5 million from the drug rings operation in San Francisco, took it down to Costa Rica, took it down to Honduras, and delivered it, and he said, directly to a CIA agent whom he named as Ivan Gomez, and who the CIA, in its report, acknowledged that there was a CIA agent in Costa Rica during those years who was using the alias Ivan Gomez, so it was kind of hard for him to have made this up, I think. The other trafficker they interviewed, which I never talked to, was a fellow named Renato Peña Cabrera, who was the military representative of the FDN and the political representative of the FDN in San Francisco between 84 and 82. And he told the CIA Inspector General pretty much the same thing. He made about 6 to 8 trips from San Francisco to Los Angeles. He carried between $500,000 and $1 million with him on each trip. And the men he was giving this money to told him that parts of this money was going to the Contras. He was a convicted cocaine trafficker. He became a government witness. The CIA, I don't think, found anything to contradict him. So I think it's a lot more accurate to you. I mean, I have no idea how many millions, and I have no idea how much of these millions actually went to the soldiers in the field and how much of it was used by these CIA agents down there to buy houses and girlfriends and gamble. But, I mean, the money was going down there, and it was going down there in large amounts.
The dope money from these various operations is washed through major money center banks.
No.
BCCI. Nick and Hand.
The Panamanian banking industry.
Certainly, Panama has been a major center of narco traffic, but that's been primarily the banks.
We removed Noriega.
Last night, I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama.
We installed the Andara government with a cabinet with a multiplicity of links to the Panamanian banking industry, which is Panama's key function in the cocaine traffic.
The newspapers are not about to tell you what's really going on.
I never would have guessed.
The Medellin cartel recruits, trains, and finances paramilitary assassination groups. They are part of the oligarchy that rules Colombia. They have formed direct alliances with the leaders of the military. The drug cartel is determined to wipe out progressive elements, the killings of trade union leaders, peasant union leaders, social activists, and progressive political figures.
Snort a line, kill a leftist.
Our government's running a war with drug money.
What, are you crazy? What the hell are you talking about?
Since World War II, the CIA has been responsible for major expansions in the heroin and cocaine trade through its covert operations.
I mean, who's responsible for all that?
The narco-industrial complex.
What is the dope business really all about?
Yeah, usually you got sort of a glimpse of the size of the operations when the police would stumble across these things. And I think one of the best examples happened in San Francisco in 83 when they broke open the Frogman case. And this was one ship that these frogmen were swimming cocaine ashore, and they had 430 pounds of it, which was the biggest drug bust in California history at that time. And that was just one ship. And if you, and I went over and I looked at the files of the Frogman investigation, and the FBI was watching ship after ship after ship from the same Colombian freight line, the Grand Colombiana line, go up and down the coast, dropping, you know, 50 kilos here, 100 kilos here, 300 kilos here, at Portland, at Seattle, at Los Angeles. So, you know, it was a big operation. And Meneses, Norma Meneses, who was the head of this ring, I mean, the CIA called him the drug kingpin of Nicaragua in the days of Somoza. So he was no little guy. The Meneses family was very, very powerful and very influential in the Somoza regime. His brother, Edmundo, was the chief of police of Managua for many years. He was a brigadier general in the Nicaragua National Guard. He later became Somoza's ambassador to Guatemala, where he was assassinated in 1978 by Guatemalan guerrillas who claimed essentially that he was coordinating counter-revolutionary efforts in that area. Norman had another brother named Furman, who was another general in the National Guard. Norwin was sort of the Al Capone of Nicaragua. He ran a lot of gambling places. He had tour houses outside of town with waterbeds and videotape machines, which were like a novelty back then. And they were these drive-in places you can go into with girlfriends if you want. And then he had a marijuana business going. He had nightclubs going. And he could do anything he wanted because his brother is the chief of police. So, you know, it was sort of an open city. Landon was a minor official in the Nicaraguan government. He was the head of the wholesale, I think it was called wholesale markets, director of wholesale markets. And his job, and this will become important later when he gets to L.A. and begins to set up a drug network, his job was to set up demonstration projects for wholesaling agricultural goods. He had an MBA in marketing, courtesy of the taxpayers of the United States, I might add, to create wholesale markets for agricultural products. And when the Sandinistas took over, both of these men left and came to the United States, which I can't figure out how a drug trafficker the size of Norman Meneses could have been welcomed into this country, since the DEA knew he was a drug dealer since 72. 7 years later, he waltzes in here and gets a work permit and a visa and applies for political asylum. And they started selling, you know, they continued selling drugs, as Meneses had done for many years, only they started doing it for the Contras. And shortly after this happened, Blandone hooked up with this drug dealer in South Central named Freeway Ricky Ross, who at the time was about 19 or 20 years old, had tried to become a tennis player, and was looking for a college scholarship, but the problem was he couldn't read or write, so it was a little difficult for a college to let in. And which surprised him a great deal, because he said, you know, they passed me all the way through high school. As long as I was good on the tennis court, you know, nobody expected any grades or anything. And he found it wasn't the case when he got to college, so he turned to crime to make a living. And he was stripped cars and sold wheels and sold a little bit of cocaine, and he ran into an auto upholstery teacher at vocational school who was a cocaine user and a small-time dealer, and Rick got into the cocaine business that way and gradually worked his way up the ladder through the teacher's sources source until he got to the top and connected with Danilo Blandone, the MBA in marketing. And they proceeded to sort of blanket South Central with cocaine.
How much did the DEA and U.S. government officials exactly know about Norwin Meneses and his drug trafficking background? Did they have a lot of detail about that?
They had a ton. I mean, I found a DEA affidavit in those files, which went on for 3 pages about what the FBI and what the DEA knew about him. And they knew he was a multi-kilo trafficker way, way back in the 70s. They had been following him all the way. They'd found him in New Orleans in 79. They'd found him in Tampa. They'd run across him in Southern California. They had all of his nephews running around San Francisco being arrested with 20 pounds of cocaine here and 4 pounds here. And so they knew very well who he was. Why he was allowed to do what he did for so many years is still a question that I don't have a concrete answer to. I have a suspicion, but I don't have a concrete answer.
Now, I can't remember if you said the frogman, after the bust, there was $39,000 that was seized.
Oh, yeah.
What happened to that $39,000?
The morning that they executed all these raids, they went into one of the traffickers' apartments, and in his nightstand, amidst the hand grenades and the machine gun parts and the silencer catalogs and the cocaine, they found $36,000 in cash, and they said, aha, this is drug money, which I think is a reasonable conclusion given the circumstances. And they said, we're taking this away from you, we're keeping it. And about a year, right before he was going to trial, the judge in the case got letters from two Contra officials in Costa Rica, which you even wrote about one of them in your book, this Aviles,
right.
the lawyer, saying, well, you know, that money you found in Julio's nightstand really isn't drug money, it's Contra money, and it's we want it back, and you're impeding the process of democracy by keeping it. And so naturally, the U.S. government, who's very concerned about impeding democracy, gave the money back to the drug trafficker, because heavens knows they didn't want to be accused of getting in the way of progress. So, Seth Rosenfeld from The Examiner wrote a story about this in 1986 and was immediately denounced by the U.S. Attorney Joe Russinello as a conspiracy theorist and a guy who's just trying to undermine the Contras, et cetera, and the CIA had absolutely nothing to do with it. And now we know, thanks to the Inspector General's report, that the CIA flew their general counsel to San Francisco and sat down with the U.S. attorney and said, look, give the money back. And I think in a cable afterwards, they said he was extremely deferential to our wishes. So they and Joe got along famously. And then they wrote, and then these guys are great. They write cables back and forth to each other saying, boy, we sure dodged a bullet that time. Well, if anybody ever found that out, it'd sure play hell our program in Central America. We got to keep an eye on this thing because, people could say the CIA is going into drug business.
Shut down the CIA.
Whoa, listeners, that was a Dark Alliance mix from the best of 2005. Woo.
That was fun.
And that got a little taste there of some of the ways they do things and how Colombia fits into the picture and how money is used.
Well, interestingly, that whole thing with... This is a connection that I made about 10 years ago when I was studying. At the same time, I was studying free trade. I was studying the drug war. And a friend of mine had just unloaded a whole bunch of information from me that actually coincidentally came from Bev Collins, who ran with the Canadian Action Party in this riding.
Yeah.
And he had photocopied a bunch of her information, and then I got a chance to look at it and read it and photocopy it. And at the same time I was doing this, just starting with working with cannabis culture. And the two all of a sudden came together for me. I think I was probably high at the time. It was such, you usually get these kind of world-shattering sort of visions when you're really high. And I realized that free trade and the drug war were two sides of the same thing, and that there was actually something going on here that was really important that nobody touched on before. And that's when I wrote my first article, which is Multinationals Will Kill for Drugs, that was reprinted probably a couple million times and translated into several languages by now, and already in its, I think, third reprinting, and or fourth is it now, but anyways, it's very interesting. What the premise for that was that the drug war was being used as a way to secure resources in third world countries like Colombia and various other South American countries. And now we saw that. I saw that come up after I'd written this article. It came up with the organization Geopolitical Drug Watch published a study that showed that most of the really heinous drug war atrocities, the killing of whole villages, the destruction of economies, the driving of peasants into the wastelands, and all that stuff was all happening in all this supposed guerrilla activity. It was all happening in areas where They had really rich mineral content, lots of emeralds, lots of oil.
Yeah.
You know? So, and of course, you know, these people were then labeled narco-guerrillas and driven off their land was taken and exploited for its resources. And this is what we saw again with that story that you were reading. Again, more references to that same paradigm. So it's good that this has become common knowledge over the last 10 years since I first wrote that article. I'm glad that it's out there. And I'm hoping that more and more people will become aware of this because it's a really important aspect of our geopolitical structure that is really under-acknowledged and even refuted by governments, the very governments who perpetrate it. And another thing, too, I was thinking about while I was listening to that, the narco stuff there, was it's interesting because I think that drug use is an integral part of our human nature. It's like it's something that...
It's like food, sex, shelter, you know, like...
Totally. It's a human hunger that can never be... You can never take it away. You're not going to stop people from having sex like they tried to do in the Victorian era any more than you're going to stop people from doing drugs like they're doing now. And you can have a war on sex and you can turn it into a witch hunt even, you know. Or you can have a war on drugs and turn it into a witch hunt. Or you can even have a war on food, you know, let's try and stop people from eating food.
Well, it's one of the staples of existence. And so anytime it's like water, food, sex and drugs, any one of those is a profit-making situation. And so we can see multinational corporations have taken over the seeds through biogenetic engineering. They've taken over the sexual kind of context in the States using media and the what they've done to women through media and through the sexual relations. Water control, you know, water's worth more than gasoline right now, and drugs are no different than any one of those things. It's a guaranteed seller, and the multinational corporations are getting their slice of the pie.
Well, totally, and to bring that concept full circle, I was reading Giorgio Samarini's Animals and Psychedelics last summer. And it was interesting that animals, too, have this very basic drive. And that's what I realized that it was actually this. It's not just, well, you know, I like to do, you know, I like to smoke pot. Oh, well, I like to rock climb. It's not even like that. It's like there's a deeper human need for psychedelics, just as there may be a deeper human need to do exercise, not necessarily rock climb, but to do exercise. So... What's happening is, I believe, is that the war on drugs is creating an exclusive market. I think that the government knows, hey, we can't shut this down. So what the CIA does is instead of shutting it down is they harness it and they use it to their benefit.
They've always harnessed it.
They create an exclusive market for themselves, essentially, where another market would just take its place if they hadn't done it. So, but, you know, it's kind of a weird kind of black magic voodoo that they're engaging in, because while they're claiming to suppress this thing to be fighting against it, they're actually doing it. And so we end up with a really twisted society it's kind of like the preacher who, you know, stands in front of the pulpit and preaches abstinence and then, you know, goes and screws a bunch of his clergy members or something, you know.
Yeah,
like.
Totally. And it's been going on forever. One day we should invite Paul Dean to talk about how when they banned alcohol in the States, how the army would grow corn in certain regions to supply alcohol, and they did that covertly so they could raise money for munitions. You know what I mean? It's been going on forever. The opium wars between Britain and China, the trade of hashish and stuff through Morocco, Algiers, all, you know what I mean? Like, it's drugs have always been used. We think it's new. It's just new drugs. We've all of a sudden gone from a situation where like drugs from all over the world can be transported now all over, and so it's like a blanket of different drugs. I was having a brainwave the other day that to activism, pot is to activism what buffalo was for the native peoples. Like cannabis, for what it gives and the nourishment that it gives to the spirit and the its associations with music, art, culture, rebellion, that that is like the buffalo to the native peoples, and that's why they're trying to clamp down. That's why they've decided to go so heavy on the soft drug end of things, is because it's so, like, I hate to say, but cocaine and heroin doesn't cause activists to blossom. You know what I mean? Like, I've never heard of a cocaine activist or heroin activist ever. I mean, there's activists for people who do needle exchanges and that kind of thing, but what I'm talking about is the drug itself has never driven a group of people to become activists like cannabis has.
Well, I think that's basically what makes it so safe. I think that's why the American government wants to crack down on pot instead of heroin.
And that's the buffalo. You know, it's our buffalo. It's our nourishment, our... like what keeps, you know, the why there is so many cannabis activists and people who believe that it is the tree of life. But, yeah, oh, man.
Well, it's also partly about the mental state, right? A lot of psychedelic substances, like LSD, especially the more non-addictive ones, like LSD or mushrooms or cannabis, these ones, they tend to open your mind in a way to new thoughts and new ways of looking at things, more empathic ways of looking at things, more compassionate ways of looking at things, that basically create a mindset that isn't really conducive to capitalism, because capitalism is based upon greed.
Or patriarchy.
Right. Well, the whole thing is that you know, the great strength of capitalism is that it takes into account the one of our most basic human frailties, which is greed. But the problem with it is that it also relies upon that greed for its survival. Mm-hmm. So while it takes into account one of our greatest weaknesses, it reinforces one of our greatest weaknesses at the same time. In fact, it practically requires that we be that way.
Yeah.
So. So, you know, and then by doing that, it creates this sort of illusion, this idea that we can't escape that. That's what we are.
Mm-hmm.
That we are creatures of greed and self-interest.
And that's where media comes in to keep pounding that into our skulls, that this is what you are. You are Britney Spears. You are the McDonald's munching cow that we need. You know, like, you are this person. But I've got to say that thanks to the internet and thanks to, you know, the activist network, that in years past we would never have figured out what we're figuring out. Like, the U.S. is going to invade Venezuela. We know that. It's going to happen. And so there is the chance that there can be, like, a preemptive strike by activists and by people in other countries to, like, say, hey, this is coming, don't fall for it. The puppet show, it's like, no, it's seeing a glimpse of the play before it hits the stage, you know, and getting it out.
Well, Bertolt Brecht, the famous playwright, called that Verkunft, which translated sort of loosely into what they called E-effect, or A-effect, or what they call alienation effect. The idea was that when a play is done poorly, that the structure of the play kind of falls apart, and the verisimilitude, or your ability to believe in it, also falls apart.
And I like this.
And this is what I think that we're seeing. He did have a social application for it. It was a metaphor for what's happening in society.
Sweet.
And that's what we're seeing right now, is through the activist networks, through these informations, these alternative information networks, is that, you know, they were getting the Verkunft.
Yeah, yeah, I like that, man. Develop that. Write an article about that. That's brilliant. No, because I feel it in my own life. Like, I honestly feel like going to Venezuela and, you know, like, going there and seeing and being with the people and coming back and saying, okay, look, like, this is what's going on. I don't know, I just feel like we know what's going on. We have a chance to do a preemptive strike on our own spiritual levels, like, to counteract, and that's a perfect explanation of it. Thanks so much for that. That's brilliant. Once you see the, you know, the weaknesses in the, it just, because when the United States invaded Iraq, we all knew it was going to happen. There was no doubt in our minds. You know, we all knew that was going to happen. And so when it did happen, it kind of, it just made it, yeah, like puppetry or like some contrived thing. It didn't seem real. It was, we knew that it was just a an excuse.
Well, the more you pay attention, the more you see the underlying realities that are informing these kinds of movements. The reason why the war on communism gets replaced by the war on drugs is that communists just aren't scary at some point. They just kind of lose their scariness to mm-hmm. some degree, you know. The Cold War is over and, you know, it's drawing close to an end. And when they know there's going to have to be something to replace it, they know they're going to have a good reason for continuing a war on their own people when they can't continue, you know, putting people away for being communists anymore on their own soil, even, you know. Even during the time when the Cold War was still in effect, there came a time when they couldn't throw people in jail in the States for being communists anymore. It just lost its effect. So then the war on drugs replaced it, you know. And then after the war on drugs started losing its bite, then we get the war on terrorism. There's a reason why these things happen this way, and it's because there's an underlying need to keep people controlled and to have them give up their power. Mm-hmm. It's all about getting us to basically kowtow and give up our power. So, you know, I mean, we're working towards hopefully a greater understanding of this, but you know, I just think that the great, you know, like, unfortunately, the masses of humanity really haven't cottoned on. There's a few of us that are getting more and more intelligent.
I think it's coming, man. I never thought I would see. I think how many people in Nelson? There was like 1,000 or 2,000 people out on the street there. Like, to me, that's huge. That didn't happen for Iraq War I. That didn't happen for Panama. That didn't happen. You know what I mean? Like, we understand the mechanisms of war. We understand the mechanisms of greed and of multinational corporations and of the U.S. foreign policy. We understand it now to a point where we're actually protesting before the war even starts. We had protests before the war even started, Dan. That is like... To me, that is just brilliant.
Well, I won't be too pessimistic. I mean, I kind of hope for the best, really, because that's, you know, otherwise everything's going to go to hell anyways. But you know, when you take a look at things and the way people are and stuff, it's like, you know, I mean, while there are a lot of us who are, you know, becoming more and more aware, there's also a constant desensitization program in place to make people accept more and more the loss of their freedoms. And, you know, we see that with the staged raids that were done on supposed terrorism. It was like a fire drill for terrorism. They were doing all these things all across the States, just freaking people out, cordoning off whole areas and going in with automatic weapons into neighborhoods and searching house by house and, you know, the whole thing. And some police stations actually refused to participate in it, but there were places where they did it, and it was done in this very covert, very sneaky way. And the way they're turning schools now into prisons, you know, they're even Ontario now, they've just approved funding for a whole new security package for the schools in Ontario. And what it's going to entail is the installation of cameras in all of the schools in Ontario. So if you're a student going to school, you're being watched.
Oh,
you're being watched 24/7. You feel like a criminal. They've been going into schools and lining up all that. They'll take all the black kids and they'll put those stupid plastic handcuffs on them and line them all up in the hallway. And anybody who's a troublemaker, and they'll search them all. And they'll do it just based on total profiling, racial and appearance profiling. And it's happening right now. It's happening all the time. You know, these kind of things, it's happening more and more. And the idea is that we are being taught to accept without question that police and authorities have a right to search, detain, arrest, and even imprison us without reasonable grounds or basically any feeling that we've committed a crime, any proof or evidence or anything that we've done anything wrong. So,
wow.
It's, you know, like, you know all this stuff, Dustin, but it's like...
No, I, yeah.
Like, so there's this, like, the darkness is, like, you know what I mean?